This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris-Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. In June 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade and ruled that the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion, sending legal and social aftershocks throughout the country. 1 year on, 14 states have near total abortion bans with no exception for rape or incest. 12 other states have severe restrictions. This new landscape puts the United States at odds with trends in many Western countries, including France, where abortion became legal in 1975. But fears that this could now change prompted a political process aimed at inscribing the right to abortion in the French Constitution. What do these developments reveal about democratic trends in the United States and France? What can we learn from comparing the legal and political implications of this issue in these two countries? To answer these questions, we turn to two constitutional experts, Olatunde Johnson and Eleonora Bottini. Olatunde Johnson is the Ruth Bader Ginsburg 59 Professor of Law at Columbia University. She teaches and writes about anti-discrimination law, congressional power, and courts. She is a recipient of several awards for her teaching and service at Columbia Law School. Prior to entering academia, Professor Johnson clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens on the U.S. Supreme Court, served as constitutional and civil rights counsel to Senator Edward M. Kennedy on the Senate's Judiciary Committee, and as a lawyer at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Eleonora Bottini is full professor of public law at the University of Caen-Normandie in France and is currently the Martin Flynn Global Law Professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law. She served previously as associate professor at Sorbonne Law School in Paris and was the Alliance Visiting Professor at Columbia University. She specializes in comparative constitutional law, French constitutional law, and legal theory. She has published several articles and book chapters in French, Italian, and English, and she's the author of a book based on her PhD thesis, Constitutional Sanction, Study of a Doctrinal Argument on the Theoretical Origins of Judicial Review. Professor Johnson, Professor Bottini, welcome to Vis-a-Vis.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Eleonora, let me turn to you first. What is the situation in France? If we are establishing this comparative perspective, where do we stand in France with regards to abortion rights? What are the conditions to obtain an abortion in France? And is there a broad consensus on abortion rights among the French population today?
In France, abortion has been officially depenalized since 1975 with the famous law sponsored by Simone Veil, at the time Ministry for Health. So abortion was made legal for the following cases: protection of the mother's health, if the fetus was deformed, and if the pregnancy was a result of rape, or if financial barriers prevented the family from caring for the child, and that up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. The law was soon then amended to 12 weeks for the time limit. And at the time, in 1975, the law is not intended as stating a right to abortion for women, because the right to life is still guaranteed by the same law. Simone Veil mostly aimed to depenalize a last resort solution for unwanted pregnancies. But I think it's important to remember that the law of 1975 was not the starting point of this depenalization. The movement in French public opinion had started some years previous, in 1971, for example, with the manifest of the 343 women who publicly admitted to having had an illegal abortion. And then in 1972 and 73 were two big trials to country, actually, were held for illegal abortions in which the article of the criminal code prohibiting abortions wasn't applied by the judges. And that is because of public opinion campaigns that were conducted at the time and during those trials by feminist intellectuals, mainly, such as Simone de Beauvoir, for example. And those trials created the condition in the French population for a general consensus on the penalization at first and on the right to abortion since then. And of course, the following battles were about the transformation from the penalization to a right to abortion for women, which has since been achieved.
It's really interesting because in the United States, it seems that there's also a consensus regarding reproductive rights, or at least in a majority of Americans, 62%, according to a recent poll, a 2022 poll by Pew Research, which explains that 62% of Americans say that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. So does that mean, Professor Johnson, that there is a discrepancy between public opinion and the Supreme Court? And I'd like to add another figure here. According to another poll by Pew, 40%, only 40% of Americans approve of the Supreme Court. So that, does that mean that there's a breakdown of trust? And what does that mean for American democracy?
Yes. So there is a big discrepancy between public support for abortion rights, especially early abortion rights, and the Supreme Court ruling. But I want to back up a little bit, especially since Eleonora was talking about the way in which the issue got framed in France. And so the difference in the United States is that you do have around the same time a big movement around decriminalization of abortion. But the ultimate body that decides that you have to decriminalize abortion is the Supreme Court, and it does it through the constitutional process, through how it interprets the 14th Amendment or the due process clause of the Constitution. And so you have a different trajectory because it doesn't go through state legislatures or through the federal legislature. And so there are things about the structure of American democracy where it's often not easy for majoritarian preferences to be realized in legislation. This may be true in other democratic systems, but we have a lot of what we call veto gates, you know, points at which legislation can be stopped. But it also shows the way in which interest groups can mobilize around the issue. And there was a kind of political alliance for a long time between Christian conservatives, evangelical voters, and a more kind of deregulatory right wing in the United States, or even conservatives who were sort of all allied around this issue. It was kind of a marriage of convenience. And it kept the issue alive in politics in a way that didn't always reflect majoritarian preferences. So the implications for today are that when you have the Supreme Court overturn a right that many people had taken as part of the landscape, there are a lot of people asking whether or not the Supreme Court itself is a legitimate institution because it's so far from public opinion, and also because they saw the overturning of Roe versus Wade as a result of a movement by this relative minority, by not the majority of the population, to put judges, justices on the bench, specifically who would achieve this outcome. So it's leading to a lot of questions about whether the Supreme Court should operate that way and whether we should have a more explicit constitutional protection for abortion.
And just to react to this, some have argued or advocated in favor of the legislator to actually come to a decision with regards to reproductive rights, as opposed to leaving that decision to the Supreme Court. Do you think that that would have been an option, or is it still an option for Congress to actually come in about this issue?
I think all along it should have been available as an option. There are different accounts. You know, there's a kind of famous account by Ruth Bader Ginsburg that says that in some sense the Supreme Court decision interrupted some of what was happening at the state and local level. And there may have been a kind of turn towards thinking about courts rather than legislatures as a way to realize these rights that some in the women's movement engaged in. But I think it understates the difficulty of codifying the right, and it has something to do with how abortion is generally framed. And even for women who have had an abortion or who believe themselves to really count on the right, there's an idea of it as being almost a shameful kind of practice. And that's why it was really interesting to hear about people stepping forward in France and saying, I had an abortion, this right is important to me. That's only now emerging in recent years in the politics of the United States. Now you do see a big effort to codify. It's a lot of the most successful efforts are starting at the state level in those states where there is majority support for having abortion rights. And there are some efforts to codify various forms of abortion protections at the federal level. Right now, they don't have the votes to do so. And it's also important to note that there is an effort also to codify the, you know, the reverse, right, at the federal level, and states are doing that too. So I think what we're going to see is a real, in the short term, real division around the issue, and states going in different directions, and then an inability to get federal legislation through unless something dramatic changes.
Right. And as we look at the ripple effects of the Roe v. Wade decision, what was the reaction in France within the broader French society, and what implications might that have? Olati was just mentioning the issue of codification. Does that have implications also in the French context?
Right after the overturning of Roe v. Wade, there have been spontaneous protests that have sparked in different parts of France, especially in Paris, in solidarity with the women in the US. There has also been slogans in English, and this is not usually, it's not common in France, as you might know, how much they're attached to the language. And especially the political community has reacted. And a lot of people have reacted in two different ways. One is to underline the differences of how the right to abortion came about in France and in the US. So, of course, one of the main elements of the discourse was where it's not the same thing in France because this right passed through the legislature multiple times. There have been a total of almost 10 laws on the right to abortion since the very first law by Simone Veil. And so this is considered as a big difference and something that, given also the lack of a strong Supreme Constitutional Court in France, would likely not happened or not have happened. And at the same time, the other reaction was, first of all, generally condemning the overturning of Roe v. Wade, especially in the left, but also the center, even the center-right, particularly coming from the party of the majority, the party of the President Emmanuel Macron. And the reaction has been to say, well, the US example, even though it is so different, shows that nothing is impossible in terms of the fragility of rights and especially of women's and reproductive rights. And so the overturning of Roe v. Wade has been called a transatlantic tragedy by one member of the National Assembly. And so the response has been introducing numerous, actually three or four at the same time, proposals for constitutional amendments in order to codify even more at the higher level of the Constitution, the right to abortion. I mean, the overturning of Roe v. Wade certainly started this conversation, which is ongoing right now.
Right. And to add to this, I'm curious about what you think of the proposal from the French Senate. So the French Senate came up with its own formulation of how the right to abortion should be included in the Constitution. And the language that it came up with states that the law determines the conditions under which a woman is free to have an abortion, end of quote. Some would have preferred, I understand, the text to refer to a woman's right to have an abortion, underlying the fact that having the freedom to an abortion and having the right to an abortion is not necessarily the same thing. Why is this distinction important? Is it an important distinction, first of all? And if it is, why is it important?
The story of how this went about is quite interesting because the initial proposal also came from the National Assembly, from the lower chamber. And it was not the very first one, which was abandoned. It was a new one. And that one contained the following language: the law guarantees the right of women to have an abortion, sort of like that, not word by word, but the law guarantees the right. And then the Senate with an amendment, changed the language into what you just mentioned. The law determines the freedom of a woman to have an abortion. And in fact, the most interesting debate from a legal point of view is not between the right and the freedom. That distinction is actually more symbolic than it is substantial. In French law, you have both terms indicating constitutional fundamental rights. The other debate is between the difference between the law determines and the law guarantees. And that actually makes a difference, because referring to the legislator as the one who determines the ways in which abortion is regulated doesn't really add anything to the situation that we now have, because the law already determines the conditions, and actually determining the condition is something very open to interpretation, and reducing the number of weeks, for example, for women to have an abortion is a way of determining the condition, right? While if the constitutional amendment or the constitution says that the law guarantees the right, then it's much more difficult for a legislator to justify the reduction of such right, whether it's in terms of time limits or other of the conditions. So the real difference between the two versions of the text, which is now still pending, is which sort of constraints to put on the legislator, the future legislator, in the eventuality of a majority wanting to reduce such a right. So right now, the question is still open at the time we're recording this podcast,
which is in June 2023. I want to come back to you, Olati, on the basis for the original Roe v. Wade decision, which was based essentially on the right to privacy. That's how the right to abortion was actually inscribed in that ruling. Some have argued, and in particular Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself argued, that anchoring that decision on privacy was too broad, and that would have been better to base this on the Equal Protection Clause. In other words, that an attack on abortion rights constituted an attack on gender equality. Do you think that that would have been an option? And is it still an option for those who are arguing in favor of abortion rights in the U.S.?
Yes, this was certainly an argument that Ruth Bader Ginsburg made, that this should have been grounded as a matter of gender equity. And you can see why, right? There are all sorts of connections between your ability to control your reproductive outcomes, when you can have children, that determine whether or not women can participate equally as in society. My own personal view is that this is a matter of liberty or autonomy and a matter of gender equity. I think the issues are really deeply connected and related. I wouldn't just ground it in gender equity, even though I see these arguments about your ability to participate in the workforce. And also, I think citizenship is a key dimension of equality. But I do think it's also a matter of bodily autonomy and liberty. And it doesn't seem so far afield from the decisions around questions like sterilization or contraception to have come up with the right to that kind of bodily autonomy in the context of an abortion. I also think that the fundamental question that the Supreme Court seems to be struggling with in Dobbs is whether a right that is not specifically articulated in the Constitution should be protected by the Constitution. And I think that would be presented whether or not it was under equal protection or whether it was under due process. So the major problem is that we don't actually have a gender equity provision in our Constitution, unlike most modern constitutions, like an Equal Rights Amendment. We have it under some state constitutions, but not under that. We also don't have the right understood as an abortion right or a right to that kind of bodily autonomy explicitly protected in our Constitution. So I think it would be interesting to think about whether or not some dimension of the right should have more explicit constitutional protection. Right now, in terms of where arguments can go, the Supreme Court in Dobbs adopted a very kind of narrow view of the Equal Protection Clause. But the issue hasn't been fully briefed to the court, and I think it's still open if people wanted to try that route. States also have privacy protections, and they also have equal protection clauses, and some of them have equal rights amendments. And so those arguments are available at the state level, that when you restrict abortion, it violates state constitutional provisions. And some of those arguments have already been successful, mostly on privacy grounds, but people are making equal protection arguments. So we'll see. I don't think that it will completely decide the issue in the end at the federal level, but I think that there's still arguments that I would pursue if I were a litigator.
Mm-hmm. And I want to come back, Olati, with to a question that has to do with the longer term implications as well, and the disparity in which the Dobbs decision is impacting different sectors mm-hmm. of the population. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, indeed, the overturning of Roe v. Wade will disproportionately impact women of color in particular. What do you think are the potential implications of this decision for racial disparities in terms of health, in terms of finances, in terms even of, you know, criminal penalties?
I mean, I think it's devastating for poor women and for women of color. I mean, it's already been devastating. And the reason for that is that because of our federalist system, and because people can get on planes and travel, because of disparities in access to health care, generally, if you are middle class or upper middle class, you're going to have more options. You can go out of state and you can get an abortion. And the access to contraception in the first place and that kind of reproductive care is already higher than they are for women of color and poor women. My hope is that it influences thinking about these questions connected to a larger reproductive justice and family health framework. And I think you see some movement in that direction. So, for instance, people proposing that there's broader access to contraceptive care, that there's more attention to the kind of health care that people get when they are pregnant. I don't think anyone should be forced to carry a pregnancy if they don't want it. But at the same time, people may see their options differently if they have access to reproductive care. And then there's also family and medical leave, where the United States is the only industrialized country not to have paid family and medical leave. All of those things are really important in creating a fuller array of choices for women of color. One of the critiques of the reproductive rights movement from women of color has been that it's too limited to think of about it as a right to abortion. You have to honor the right to have children or not to have children. And part of that is, what is the care system around poor women and women of color?
Actually, to go back to what Olati was saying about emerging movements and changing politics around reproductive rights.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Even though the situation is different in terms of broad political consensus on abortion in France, there is certainly no consensus on the place for women's rights and reproductive rights in the Constitution. And I think this is really an emerging political debate that is not at all settled. There are polls showing that a overwhelming majority of the French population seems to be in favor of constitutionalizing abortion rights. Some talk of 80-81%. But in terms of both legal academia, legal scholars, lawyers, and politicians, there are opposing arguments that are particularly strong on at least two things. One is, and it's interesting to have this discussion over in a transatlantic conversation, because one is whether it is appropriate for the French constitution or constituent power to react to something that happened abroad. So there's a sort of constitutional protectionism, in a sense, that one way or the other, the French constitution shouldn't react to external factors. And one other, I think, even more important debate is whether reproductive rights should be in the constitution altogether. And there is a very strong conservative, but not in a political sense only, argument or stance that is to say that those matters, women's matters, are better dealt with by the legislature. But the Constitution is a serious thing, and it talks about institutions and separation of powers, and it should stay that way. We shouldn't include those rights. And so I think that what happened in the US and all the debate that has originated since really opened up such a conversation that wasn't there before in France.
Olati, it's interesting that, Eleonora is talking about the way in which the Dobbs decision has had an influence in France. I'm just wondering whether in the United States there is an interest in looking outward with regards to this issue, looking at countries like Ireland or Italy and thinking, okay, well, there are a number of countries that are and have recently also enshrined abortion rights. You know, are there people in the United States and particularly in government who feel that the United States is really not following the trend of other Western countries? And are they listening to what is going on elsewhere?
Yes, I think there's a definite listening to what is going on elsewhere and thinking about the ways in which our system is so different. And a lot of people, activists in the United States, are drawing on recent victories in places like Mexico and Ireland to say that the proper framing of abortion rights is situated within a larger framework of reproductive care. One of the things that was really striking in the case of Dobbs was that it came from Mississippi. And Mississippi has some of the worst healthcare outcomes for women in general, certainly for women of color, for Black women in particular, the highest maternal mortality rate in the United States, the highest infant mortality rate in the United States. And there's a deep connection between the indifference to maternal care and this and the cavalier way in which abortion rights are restricted that a lot of social movement actors have been highlighting, right? And so I think there's looking to the framing in other countries as well as the substantive protections that are there. But then a last final way, maybe more appealing to those of us who are constitutional law geeks, has been thinking about American constitutionalism and how different it is. So Eleonora was talking about whether or not to amend the Constitution. This is a terrifically difficult thing to do in the American context. It's a very hard constitution to amend. And you had ordinary people, ordinary citizens, because of Dobbs, realizing this about the American Constitution, that it's very hard to change it, and that the way in which the current conservative majority interprets constitutional provisions is using a philosophy of originalism that really ties us to interpretations that are, you know, over a century old of the Constitution. And so that raises real questions about democratic legitimacy. We always see our Constitution as being kind of at the vanguard because so many countries modeled their Constitution on the American Constitution. But now there's a real conversation about the aspects of our Constitution that are not well equipped for a modern democracy, in addition to questions around interpretation, about whether or not it should be amended. There's the question of terms for the Supreme Court and whether the justices should have shorter terms or a retirement age. And so you see a real opening up of conversations about constitutional design that are going far beyond the academy.
Great. Well, listen, Olati, Eleonora, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for helping us to bring clarity and insight in these complex issues. Thank you so much.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris Panthéon Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Monica Hunter-Hart and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook, Twitter X, and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.